group of people who helped us put this meeting on, and we're going to do some special acknowledgments tonight at dinner of all of the people, the planning committee, that really helped put this meeting on. But we know everyone's anxious to get started, so I'd like to ask Jason Kuhn, PanCAN's chairman of the board, to come up.
Thank you very much. I think the first thing for me to do really quickly is to speak to you all about the genesis of this event and why we're here today. Back in the spring of 2003, my father was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And I was the person who became responsible for directing his treatment. Within a week of his diagnosis, I got on a plane from Tampa, and I flew all over the U.S., went to 12 different institutions, met with various oncologists, researchers, scientists, some of you who are in this room today. And I spoke to the researchers and doctors about the options for my father. I held out a tremendously large carrot. I held out $1 million carrot for the institution that was able to successfully treat him. And I found disappointment on two fronts. Number one, that in the year 2003, there was absolutely nothing that could be done for a patient with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. The second was, I was appalled at the state of the science just 4 years ago. It was baffling to me for somebody who has no scientific background, no medical background, how backwards the incentive system was, the research system was, in pushing the science forward for pancreatic cancer. It was baffling to me that there was relatively no dollars available from the NCI and relatively few dollars being given by private families, individuals. And so my father's fate was sealed, and he passed away 10 months after he was diagnosed. But I joined the board of PanCAN that summer and got to meet Julie and the wonderful people that were involved with PanCAN at the time. And I made it my life's work to make pancreatic cancer my cause. And so the mission began for me. And I look at problems from a more entrepreneurial aspect. I solve business problems every day. And so I looked at the system in which you all operate. And it just didn't make any sense to me. It didn't make any sense that the grant system that the NCI works under incentivizes you all to not take big risks. In business, we hold large carrots out there for individuals that take big risks. In the scientific world, you're incentivized to take smaller risks, so the money and the funding is more certain. Well, I want to change that. And back in 2004, I decided that I wanted to hold a conference. I wanted to get the smartest people that I knew of in a room together, figuratively lock the door and not let you out until we had a clear direction on where we were going, a clear methodology as to how we were going to move the needle substantively forward on this disease, how much money we need to get there. Whether it's 10 million, 100 million, a billion, let's figure it out. and then to go forward from this meeting and communicate together and with each other, because that was the other thing that just appalled me. The institutions don't communicate. The researchers don't communicate. And so there was research being done at multiple institutions with almost zero communication about the success or failure of that research. We don't do that in business, by and large. And so I set out to change the model, if you will. And along my course, I met Cynthia Strom, who is here with us today in the back. Cynthia, will you just wave your hand for a second? Cynthia lost her dad as well not too long ago. And the two of us put our heads together and said, we need to hold this type of meeting, this type of event. And to be honest with you, it started out as a private endeavor. When I joined PanCAN, research was not at the forefront of that organization. But as I became more involved, I like to think that one of the contributions that I've made to PanCAN is to move research front and center. And I'm very, very excited that PanCAN has gotten behind the research front and has decided to host this meeting today. I said to Julie back about a year and a half ago, as we spoke about this event, I said, if PanCAN puts it together, I will pay for it. And she said, okay, you have a deal. And she gave me a number. And lo and behold, a year and a half, that number changed dramatically. But there have been other people who you will meet this weekend who have also contributed toward this event. But this is where I feel my life's work is beginning. I have to date contributed or pledged over $500,000 personally toward pancreatic cancer research. Now, to be sure, there are a great many who have given and pledged more. But not nearly enough people. And this disease is where my life is going until I can find a cure. Until we can get this thing to the state of where prostate cancer is today, to the state of where AIDS is today, where maybe we're not going to get rid of the problem, but people who have the unfortunate diagnosis of pancreatic cancer can live with it. Because it was unbelievable to me, who knew nothing about this disease 4 short years ago, that there were cancers out there that could take your life in 3, 6, 10 months. So that's where we are today, and I wanted you to all know where the genesis of this event came from. I want to thank Julie and her staff for doing a terrific job for putting this event on. I want to thank Cynthia for joining with me to have the foresight for this event. And most importantly, I want to thank everybody sitting in this room. Because, as I said last night, it is because of you. It is the effort that you put into this every single day of your lives as to why I have hope that we are going to get this thing licked. Thank you very, very much.
So I just want to spend a little bit of time talking to all of you about PanCAN and what it is that we do. I know that we have a lot of people in the room who already know who we are, but we also have some new faces, and I just want you all to have an understanding of who the organization is. Jason talked a little bit about it, but where this summit falls into our grand scheme. PanCAN was founded in 1999, so we're 8 years old. The organization was founded by three people who had all lost parents to the disease. And Pam Acosta Marquardt, one of our co-founders, is actually in the back of the room in the red shirt. Pam has been on our board of directors for the last 8 years, and just 3 weeks ago came on staff as our new director of development. So we're very excited to have her on board in a staff capacity. So the organization was run by volunteers for the first 15 months, and in 2000, I was hired as the first full-time paid staff person. I had lost my father to pancreatic cancer the year before, and paths crossed in a way that I never thought they would, and I came on board at PanCan in a staff capacity, and we opened up our first office in Los Angeles, and that is where PanCan's national headquarters are located. We're about 10 minutes south of LAX, so we encourage all of you, when you're coming through LA, to come down and visit us at our office. When we started, it was just myself in terms of staff, and today we have over 40 staff members in our office providing programs and services to the community. So it's been a pretty exciting growth rate over the last 7 years. We have 145,000 people in our database, and if you compare that to just 2002, 5 years ago, we only had 14,000 people. So we've definitely been on a big growth rate over the last few years. We opened up a Washington, D.C. office last summer in 2006, and Megan Gordon-Don is here from our Washington, D.C. office. We have two staff out there, as well as some consultants that we're working with on our government affairs program. We have 80 volunteer affiliates around the country that are creating awareness and helping us raise monies in communities across the country. And last summer, we also launched a Japanese affiliate, and Yoshi Majima is in the back. He is running the Japanese affiliate out in Japan and has brought a couple of Japanese researchers that are here with us this weekend. This is just to give you an idea of our revenue growth. Back in 2000, our budget was about $225,000. And this past year, we raised $8.2 million. So we have increased our revenue growth by about 35 to 40% every year and plan to continue to grow at that rate. So it's pretty exciting. The possibilities and the potential that we have as we continue to grow this budget, especially on the research side. PanCan really has a very comprehensive approach to attacking this disease and helping this community. We have a threefold strategic plan. The first is research, and that includes both our government affairs program to increase the research dollars that the federal government invests in this disease, as well as directly funding research, which right now we're doing through career development awards and pilot grants. We also have a comprehensive patient services program, as well as education and awareness that we're doing around the country to help raise awareness about pancreatic cancer. On the research side, our strategic priority is to advance initiatives in early detection, translational research, and the development of new therapeutics, and to increase the number of researchers working in the field through PanCan's peer-reviewed grant system. So what that means, in 2003, PanCan started funding career development awards. We really looked at the field and said, as a very small organization, how can we have an impact if we were to fund research? And in 2000, the PRG report for pancreatic cancer basically stated that there were only 10 full-time researchers with 100% focus in pancreatic cancer, and that one of the recommendations of that report was that we needed to encourage young investigators to go into this field. So in 2003, PanCan partnered with the AACR to establish a career development award system. And we have to date funded 27 scientists, and it's been a very exciting time. We basically have provided the criteria to the AACR. The AACR then helps us market and outreach to the scientific community that these grants are available. And then the grants are selected through a peer-reviewed system through AACR. And that's very important to us, that it is a peer-reviewed system, that the very best science is being selected so that we can really move the science forward. Our plan over the next year, 07-08, is to fund an additional $1 million in grants, or 12 additional scientists. And this last year, we launched a new program, a pilot grant program, that we decided at the last minute really to launch because we had brought in extra dollars for the year. We launched the call for applications at the end of February and asked for the applications back 5 weeks later, and we got 54 applications, which was pretty amazing in such a short amount of time, which just again goes to show the ideas are out there. There's researchers that want to study this, and everybody's just looking for funding. So we were very excited about that, and now we will continue to fund pilot grants over this next year. But as Jason said, we are looking at charting a deeper direct investment in research. And part of this next year, this next 12 months, PanCAN is looking at several different things to help shape a business plan for growing PanCAN's research portfolio. One of the main initiatives was, of course, hosting this summit and looking at the ideas that you all come up with this weekend, as things that PanCAN can possibly think about funding in the future. I think one of the roles that PanCAN, or the ability that PanCAN has, is that we can bring people together that wouldn't normally come together to talk about topics that they might not normally talk about. And that's a role that we can play as an unbiased participant in the scientific community. And that's why this meeting was so important to us, to bring a bunch of people together that normally wouldn't have come together. And we hope that by the end of the weekend, we will have some new ideas or new ideas for new directions. And PanCAN will look at that as we continue to develop our research portfolio. There's also an NCI State of the Science meeting at the end of November. And the NCI will be looking at different things that are happening in the pancreatic cancer research community. I think namely clinical trials and the future direction of clinical trials for pancreatic cancer. And that'll be an important aspect for PanCAN to look at, is what is the NCI's plans for this disease. And then finally looking at what is industry doing for pancreatic cancer and how can PanCAN possibly play a role in pushing pancreatic cancer further up the priority list for industry in terms of what they're doing for this disease. And taking all three of those things, which are all very important, NCI funding, innovative new directions for pancreatic cancer, and looking at what industry is doing, and then creating a real business plan for how PanCAN can play a role in that and accelerating that progress or that process moving forward. On the government affairs side, our strategic priority is to secure additional federal dollars for pancreatic cancer research and increase the number of advocates that are involved with PanCAN. As you all know, federal funding is extremely important for moving cancer research forward. When we started our advocacy efforts in 1999, pancreatic cancer was receiving about $17.5 million from the NCI. Last year, that number was up to 74.2. So we're definitely making progress, although as you all know, it is extremely competitive. The NCI dollars are leveling out, the federal dollars are leveling out, and we have an upward battle to make sure that Congress continues to increase the overall dollars that are being put towards cancer research in this country. As I said, we opened up a DC office last year, and in April of 2007, we hosted our very first lobby days. We had over 165 people come in from around the country, and they were up on the Hill talking about the needs of the pancreatic cancer community, the needs that all of you have as researchers, and why it's important that cancer research remains a priority in this country. Our plan for the next year is to really start to develop very specific pancreatic cancer legislation. What can we go up to members of Congress and talk about specifically that are your needs? And things that come out of this summit may help us shape that policy. We're also continuing to increase our visibility with Congress, and most importantly, building a really robust advocacy network. We can do all of these wonderful things in DC, but if constituents around the country aren't telling their members of Congress why this is important to them, members of Congress aren't going to take action. So our advocacy network and our volunteer network is extremely important to being able to move all of these things forward. And this is just an interesting chart. It shows you pancreatic cancer compared to the other five leading cancers in terms of dollars from NCI. And you can see pancreas if you look at the charts, you can visually see how, you know, how below, far behind pancreatic cancer is compared to the other cancers. And I think really looking at this chart, what it tells us is, you know, look at breast cancer and what an amazing job advocates and awareness has done for increasing the research dollars for that disease, and that we just need to do the same thing for pancreatic cancer. And we are slowly moving the dollars up, but we're nowhere near where we need to be. PanCAN has a comprehensive program called Patient and Liaison Services, or PALS. And our priority there is to support patients and families by continuing to offer the highest quality evidence-based pancreatic cancer information to a greater number of patients and families in the United States. A new direction that we're also looking at in this area is to aim to improve care for people with pancreatic cancer by expanding our evidence-based educational opportunities for health professionals. The way PALS works is that patients and families call in, they talk to one of our trained PALS associates in our office, they ask them questions about clinical trials, disease and treatment information, pain management, diet and nutrition. They want to talk to somebody else. Whatever the person's issue is, they talk to our PALS associates. Our PALS associates then gather information together for them in a specialized information packet and send that packet out within 24 hours. It's a case management system. So if someone calls back into the PALS program, they'll be reconnected with the same PALS associate and they'll continue their conversation where they left off the last time. To date, we've served 21,000 patients since the inception of PALS in 2002. Right now, over the next year, we will have an average of about 750 contacts per month, and about 600 healthcare professionals will request our information and materials to have in their offices on an annual basis. We have a unique clinical trials database that houses about 105 verified trials, and we have a staff person that is solely their job, is to work with investigators around the country to make sure that we have all of the pancreatic cancer clinical trials that are going on, that we have all of the sites where those trials are being done, and then when families call in, we ask them a few questions, and we were able to do an eligibility search for trials that they may be eligible for. We're also creating educational resources. We have Spanish-speaking resources now. That's a new tool. We have a survivor and caregiver network, and this next year we will host 5 patient symposiums in cities around the country. And then finally is our community outreach and affiliate relations. We want to establish a unified volunteer network in order to expand outreach efforts and increase our fundraising event revenue. Our affiliate growth plan is to eventually have affiliates in 96 cities across the country, and these are 96 strategic cities where there are big cancer institutions, major cities, important members of Congress, a lot of people in our database. Currently, we have about 80 of those 96 cities where we have affiliates already established. Last year, we hosted 250 events throughout the year through our affiliates. We distributed 1,283 healthcare professional packets through the community so that healthcare professionals knew about the programs and services that we have available. We distributed 30,000 purple ribbons. 11,000 emails were sent to members of Congress. And this next year, our goal through our volunteer network is to raise $3.2 million. So they are a very important part. They really are the arms and legs of the organization and why we've been able to grow as fast as we have. And finally, I put this picture up. This is a group of survivors, over 50 survivors, who were at our LA symposium last year. And I think it all comes back around to these people. This is why we're all here. This is why we are fighting to push the boundaries of pancreatic cancer research this weekend, because there are people that need us to find the answers, and they need us to find the answers quickly. So with that challenge, I will turn the microphone over to Jeffrey Wall. who is on the planning committee or has been on the planning committee for putting this summit together and has just been a wonderful friend to PanCAN. I had the privilege of being on Capitol Hill with Dr. Wall for a day and watched him talk to members of Congress. And I wanted to sit closer to him because he sounded so good. You just wanted to be around him. He knows his facts. He knows his stuff. And it was a privilege to be able to spend the day with him. And we're honored to have him here with us today. So, Dr. Wall.
Thanks, Julie, for that wonderful introduction to PanCAN and to the important work that you do. Julie had asked me to just start off the conference, try to increase your creative juices, your motivation, as if you need it, and give you kind of a background for what we're here for, what we hope to get out of this conference. There are deliverables that will be generated. But first, I wanted to give you a little bit of a personal story about how I got involved in this. It started out in the spring of this year when Ron Evans called me. And he told me that Bill Isikoff had just called him. And Bill had asked Ron to start to work with him to develop a meeting of people from different fields to discuss the topic of pancreatic cancer, at which point Ron said, "Great, I have never worked in pancreatic cancer." And Bill said, "Well, that's okay." And Ron said, "That's all right, I'll get Jeff. Jeff Wall will help me organize it." So Ron asked me, and I said, "That's great, Ron. I've never worked in pancreatic cancer. Let's get Inder." So we went to Inder Verma. And so we got Inder because Inder knows everyone everywhere and knows everything about everything. And besides that, he's the only one who we knew who had anywhere near the amount of energy that Bill Isikoff had. So we thought that with Bill Isikoff and Inder sitting at the same table, we would kind of have an energy neutral position that we could deal with. Well, that didn't work out. Because after Bill asked all of us to go to breakfast, and of course the last thing I wanted to do was help to organize another meeting after having just come off of the AACR annual meeting of this year and the AACR annual meeting of the previous year and the previous year before that. But Bill prevailed, and Ron and Inder and I have been privileged to work with Bill and PanCAN to develop this meeting. And of course Daphna Barsaghi and others have been instrumental in developing the invitation list that resulted in all of you coming. And so I'm greatly appreciative of all of you coming here, giving up your precious time, and yet another weekend, one of the few weekends that you would have during the summer. So I want to thank you very much for that. First, I want to reiterate perhaps some of the issues that Julie just brought up. Pancreatic cancer has an incidence that isn't very high, about 37,000 new cases in 2007. About 12 people per 100,000 are expected to get the disease. That isn't the problem. The problem, of course, is the mortality. The mortality is almost equal to the incidence. And furthermore, the five-year survival is very bleak. So as was indicated by Jason, this is the kind of cancer which today brings the kind of fear to people that the average cancer brought 30 years ago. And for so many cancers, many childhood leukemias and adult leukemias and lymphomas and breast cancer, so much has been done to change the equation where people can either be cured of their cancers or they can live with them for long periods of time. But with pancreatic cancer, that isn't the case, as you all know. Now, another motivation that I've had for trying to bring people from different fields together is that the mortality and incidence have actually remained the same for the past three decades. So we need to do something about this. And recently, Ron and Inder and I were told of the diagnosis of a close friend and colleague of ours who was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and of course it was detected late, as it almost always is. So for us, it provides now a special personal incentive to make sure that this weekend is successful. And I'd like to be successful with Bill Gates' creation here. Okay. So what are the problems? Well, we just talked about the medical problem. Things haven't changed too much in 3 decades, and part of that is due to the funding problem. Now, although the incidence isn't that high, as we've already just said, the death rate is extraordinarily high, causing pancreas cancer to be the 4th leading cause of death among men, the 5th leading cause of death among women. And yet, the 2000 funding that I found, Julie, was $72.2 million. It actually would have been $66 million had PanCAN not been involved. And I'll tell you, the first time I met the people from PanCAN was on the Hill when I attended a One Voice Against Cancer OVAC meeting. And of the 200 people or so who were in the room, I swear 150 of them were from PanCAN. And you have never seen a more motivated, diligent, well-informed group of people. So when Bill also told me that PanCAN was going to be involved in this meeting, of course, that provided the final motivation that I needed to spend my time to develop it. So thank you, PanCAN. But still, that $72 million isn't nearly enough. And the reason is that when you look at the percentage of deaths due to cancer that's represented by pancreatic cancer, it's 7% of all deaths due to cancer, but pancreatic cancer only constitutes 1.2% of the budget. And that hides an important fact that you never hear about in these figures. In 2004, $1.5 billion was spent treating people with pancreatic cancer, and those treatments caused no significant increase in survival or quality of life. $1.5 billion, it doesn't seem to me, Jason, to be well spent money. $1.5 billion on ineffective treatments, $72 million on research, when we know the value that research can bring to benefits in cancer detection, treatment, and survival. So we need to change that equation. Okay, so what are the meeting goals? There's a very simple one that's been difficult to achieve. We need to put our brains together. There are people here from different areas to combine your expertise, different perspectives, in order to solve the problems that make pancreatic cancer so deadly. What are those? There have been a number of think tanks that have been held over the years at the NCI and by PanCAN itself. And what always comes out is the following two areas that we need to focus on. One is methods for earlier detection. And methods for getting the laser light to work. Well, let's see. Anyway, you can see that. So methods for earlier detection. And actually, yesterday, in just perfect timing for this meeting, there was a paper published from Northwestern University in Clinical Cancer Research that describes a new endoscopic-based method for earlier detection of cancer, of pancreatic cancer, in patients who are at risk for the disease, those who have chronic pancreatitis or those who have an inherited predisposition. And what this is, it's an endoscopic method that takes a small biopsy and then it's analyzed by an optical method. And there are changes in the, bile duct? Is it bile duct? The duodenum. And there's some people from Northwestern who participated in that research here that we hope that they will talk about it, that you can see those changes. And I think that this represents an important advance forward, although, of course, it will only be used in people who are at risk. You couldn't use this as, a common screening method. So we need better, more general methods that can be used in order to detect the disease earlier, because when you detect it earlier through surgery, you can really, improve survival and quality of life. So how are we going to do that? Well, I think that we can probably borrow from other fields where we can combine imaging, bioinformatics, biomarkers, serum proteomics, or probably an integrative approach involving multiple different disciplines in order to come up with the markers that are going to be essential for earlier detection. Some of those markers are also going to be important for monitoring the effectiveness of treatment, and that gets to the next problem, and that is the treatments have largely been ineffective. The standard, as I understand it now, is gemcitabine. It's been a drug that's been used for many, many years, and we certainly need to improve on that. So how are we going to do that? Well, the mantra in other fields has, of course, been don't treat the disease as an organ site problem. Treat it as a problem, the dysregulation of the biochemical pathways that drive cell growth, survival, invasion, angiogenesis, et cetera. We obviously need to understand those pathways in pancreatic cancer and bring our knowledge of those pathways to bear on this problem. So use information from other fields. Don't perhaps invent a new wheel if we don't need to. Use drugs that are being shown to be effective, either alone or in combination with other drugs, when they're appropriate, because of our knowledge of the pathways that are abnormal in pancreatic cancer. If necessary, if there are new pathways that we find that drive the growth of the ductal cells that create pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, the leading cause of death from the pancreatic cancers, we need to develop appropriate targeted therapies, have appropriate biomarkers to look at the effectiveness of those therapies so that we know that we're giving the right drug to the right person and it's having an effect. And finally, this is not going to be inexpensive to do. We've seen how much it costs in other cancers. So we need to generate the scientific knowledge that will justify the financial investment. And of course, also we need tissue banks and other types of resources in order to be able to do the experiments to begin with. And developing tissue banks has been a problem for every cancer. It's an especially large problem for cancers that are of lower incidence, such as pancreatic cancer. So we need to work together to develop ways of banking tissues and making them readily available, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. So how can we do this? Well, Julie and her team have put together an introductory letter that I think says some of the things that I've put on this slide even better. So my first recommendation to all the presenters is to present less data, present more ideas, and to really pay attention to the time that you're given so that we can maximize discussion, because I think that's where the greatest output of this conference is going to come in, from the intersection of ideas from people in different areas during the discussion sections. We need to be able to speak openly. We shouldn't be afraid of presenting preliminary data in order to be able to get at the areas that we really understand from our own expertise, from the most recent data that we have in our laboratories, as to what the really big questions are, where the great opportunities are, and how we should approach those. And I think equally valuable, if people have tried approaches that aren't working, to bring those up as well. We don't want to pursue failed directions. And finally, let's embrace the diversity of this audience. That's very important, because I think we've seen that we need to get outside the box in order to create forward momentum in terms of improving treatments for this devastating disease. What are going to be the deliverables from this conference? If we don't have something that comes out of it, then only the people in this room are going to have benefited, and nobody in the broader community will gain the benefit of what our discussions have come to. So there will be a white paper that summarizes the meeting and the potential promising directions for the future that will hopefully be produced in a very short period of time. We need to be able to derive new ideas that give rise to new approaches, either for early diagnosis, for better treatments, for pathway identification, different ways of attacking these problems. And also, it'll be important to develop creative ways for us to think about the tools that are needed and also the financial and physical resources that are going to be required. And finally, as Julie has hinted, from the results of our discussions here, PanCAN is reconsidering its strategic plan, what directions to go and what kind of science to fund and where to fund it. And so the ideas that we generate here will be used to form a superstructure for that strategic plan to give them ideas of where they need to allocate their resources, for them to go to Congress with new information and renewed vigor to try to change the equation at Congress so that more funding is made through the NCI for research in pancreatic cancer. And also, of course, to stimulate the interest of new donors, because philanthropy is also going to be required. So with that, I'd like to conclude my remarks. Thank you. So I just want to introduce our first speaker of the meeting, and that's Diane Simeone. Diane is an associate professor of surgery in the section of general surgery in the division of gastrointestinal surgery and associate professor of molecular and integrative physiology. Diane has been working on molecular pathways that drive pancreatic cancer cell growth and has recently been very interested in asking about whether there are cells, rare cells, that act as cancer stem cells in the formation of pancreatic cancer, and whether those cells may be the culprits in terms of resistance to drugs and why diseases become so refractory to treatment. So Diane, it's a pleasure to welcome you. Thank you.
Pretty exciting to be the first speaker at a meeting such as this. I'd like to thank PanCAN for organizing this terrific meeting in this incredibly beautiful setting, and for inviting us all to attend and participate. I think we should really take advantage of this tremendous opportunity to work together to really see if we can push our field forward for the benefit of the patients that we take care of. So with that, I'm going to launch into this topic, which is an area of investigation that's, I think, new and exciting in the field of cancer biology, that of cancer stem cells, and talk about its potential relevance to pancreatic cancer. Now, I'm just going to start out by just reviewing what exactly is the cancer stem cell hypothesis. It's really composed of two parts, which may or may not be related. The first part of the hypothesis is that cancers are actually driven by cells that have stem cell properties. And that's really the part of the hypothesis I'm going to tackle today and provide data that I hope will convince you that there is some evidence that cancer stem cells may be relevant for human pancreatic cancer. The second part of the hypothesis is that cancers actually arise from tissue stem or progenitor cells, and this is a pretty controversial area in the field of pancreatic cancer research, and Steve Leach is going to talk about that in the following presentation, where he describes the potential cell of origin in pancreatic cancer. So the concept of cancer stem cells was originally born out of many studies done in the past looking at a wide variety of cell types using both in vitro and in vivo assays, where it was shown that if you looked at cancer cells, there appeared to be heterogeneous responses in proliferative assays, where there's only a small subset of cells that showed extensive proliferation. This observation led to the concept that within tumors, there are actually two subsets of cells. There was a small subset, which is typically defined as being less than 5% of the cells within a tumor, often defined by cell surface markers, that were termed cancer stem cells, and then a broad number of cells within a tumor that were more differentiated, had very limited proliferative potential. And so the traditional thinking about how cancers develop is shown here on the left, where it's thought that tumor cells are indeed heterogeneous, but that all tumor cells can give rise to tumors. The cancer stem cell theory, shown here on the right, also says that cancer cells are heterogeneous, but there's really only a small subset of cells within the tumor that can give rise to cancer. The first evidence supporting the presence of cancer stem cells in human cancers was shown in bloodborne cancers and leukemias back in the 90s, followed by an important paper that came out showing that cancer stem cells also seem to exist in solid tumors, that being the work by Max Wisha and Mike Clark, published in 2003 in PNAS on breast cancer. Since then, the presence of cancer stem cells has been supported in a number of solid tumors. Here you can see brain cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, and along with our recent work on pancreatic cancer. You can also see here that the cell surface markers that have been used to define cancer stem cells in the variety of these different cancers are distinct. There is some overlap of some of the markers, but some of the markers are quite different for the different cancers. And I think that if you think about it, in normal organs, the stem cells from different organs are going to have some common features, but also some different features, and that may be what we're seeing with the cancer stem cells within these different tumors derived from these organs. So when that work was published in 2003 identifying cancer stem cells in breast cancer, when I read that paper, I thought, I think this is a really important thing to investigate in pancreatic cancer, and I started to embark on trying to explore that. To start off and doing that kind of work, we had to develop a primary human tumor xenograft program, which we didn't have in place, and there are only, surprisingly, only a few of such programs around the country, and there is a learning curve with developing such a program. But we started out and we have developed the xenograft program to try to do these studies. It's pretty difficult to obtain adequate amounts of primary pancreatic tumors to do the kind of studies we need to do, and so xenografts are a great way to expand these specimens to be able to explore these issues. There is nice work from the Hopkins group, and there's a recent paper, I think it was last summer, by Manuel Hidalgo from Hopkins, where they showed if you take these xenografts and you passage them, that they retain their fundamental genotypic features and also the response to anti-cancer agents with passaging up to 6 passages. So they really can be used to investigate the function of cells that would be reflective of the parent tumors. So we set up our xenografts, and then we sought to identify whether there are highly tumorigenic cells within the cancer cell population. So the basic experimental paradigm is shown here. You can take pieces of primary pancreatic cancer or tumors that are established as xenografts. You digest the tumors with collagenase. And again, we had to optimize that. As many of you know, pancreatic cancers are extremely fibrotic, and so we had to figure out ways to optimize cell survival with these digestion techniques. Cells undergo then flow cytometry and are sorted based on different cell surface marker expression, and then implanted in mice, typically in a subcutaneous position, and then tumor growth is monitored. So this is just a slide showing the first 10 xenografts that we established, 2 from metastatic lesions and 8 from primaries. And we and these were the xenografts that we used for the data we published in the cancer research paper in February. We have subsequently continued to expand this program. We have about 20 primary tumors established as xenografts currently. So when we started on this, we had to decide what markers are we going to look at to try to identify cancer stem cells. And I was working in collaboration with Mike Clark at the time, and so it seemed like a good starting place was to use the markers that had been identified as relevant as cancer stem to identify cancer stem cells in breast cancer. In the case of breast cancer, the breast cancer stem cells were CD44 positive, CD24 negative, and ESA positive. And I'm going to show you the data we obtained looking at those markers. I'm also going to show you some unpublished data we have looking at some other markers, which I have listed here. So if you just take these, what we did initially was just take these individual markers and sort cells and look at tumorigenicity. And here you can see the expression of these individual markers on pancreatic cancer cells. Expression of each of these markers did confer enhanced tumorigenicity, and then we looked at different combinations, and ultimately what we found is that the most highly tumorigenic population were those cells that expressed all 3 surface markers, which represented only 0.2 to 0.8% of all human pancreatic cancer cells. if you take individual patient tumors, and here we show patient tumors from three different patients, you can, and here are double sorts of markers, 44 in ESA on the top and then 24 in ESA on the bottom, you can see that there is some variability in the expression of these markers in different patients, but we did find that the expression of these markers was preserved with passaging of these tumors. And then this is a pretty busy slide, but it's a summation of all the in vivo tumorigenicity experiments. And just to walk you through it, what we see on the y-axis is the different markers we looked at here, unsorted cells or single markers, and then combination of markers with the triple markers here at the bottom. And then on the x-axis, the number of cells we implanted in the mice. And you can see that if we just take unsorted pancreatic cancer cells, that we really didn't see any tumors form until we implanted at least 10,000 cells, where we did see tumors form in 4 out of 6 animals. If we then look at the individual markers, for example, we'll use CD24 as an example. When we implanted as few as 100 cells, we would occasionally see tumors form with marker-positive cells, and we didn't see any tumors form with marker-negative cells until we implanted 1,000 cells, which at that concentration, 10 out of 16 animals developed tumors. And then again, the combination that produced the highest tumorigenicity was with the triple markers here, with half the animals forming tumors with as few as 100 cells. And this is just a typical experiment where we injected 500 of the triple marker positive cells and got tumor formation while we didn't see that with the marker negative cells. And here you can see with H&E staining that the tumor generated from these triple marker positive cells was quite similar to the patient's primary tumor. We also saw a similar staining of using markers typically expressed in pancreatic cancer here, S100P and Stratafin. But all these tumors that we looked at were all implanted in the sub-Q, and perhaps that's not relevant for pancreatic cancer because certainly there's ample data that shows that stem cell function is relevant on the niche in which these cells are existing. And so we wanted to validate our findings in an appropriate niche. And so what we did is we took our triple marker or putative cancer stem cells and labeled them with luciferase by infecting with a lentivirus and then injected them into the pancreas. And what we found is that our data with subcutaneous injection appeared to also be true with intrapancreatic injection, where we would routinely get tumors develop in the pancreas with our cancer stem cell population, but not in the marker negative cells. And then this is just a picture of the pancreas from that mouse. So it was a gross tumor that looks very similar to a typical pancreatic cancer. Now, I talked about tumorigenicity, but an important part of calling a cell a stem cell is it has to be able to self-renew and produce differentiated progeny. And this is a slide that supports that these cells can actually self-renew and produce differentiated progeny. So if you take a primary tumor, here it's CD24 and ESA, and on the bottom 44 and ESA, and then you double sort for the double positive cell populations, and then you reimplant them in a mouse, what you see is that the tumors that develop from that regenerate the cancer stem cells, but also the marker negative cells. So they appear to have the ability to both self-renew and produce the differentiated marker negative cells. Now, all the data I've shown you so far is done in vivo, and it takes typically about 4 months for these tumors to develop, and the mice are very costly. So if we wanted to take this work a step further and say, how could we test therapeutic agents against these cancer stem cells, if you will, it sure would be nice to have a surrogate assay to try to do a more high-throughput, less expensive system. And so taking advantage of work that had been done with normal stem cells, where it's found that cells that have self-renewal properties, be it stem cells or progenitor cells, if you put them in a culture that has non-adherent substratum, then cells that have self-renewal properties will actually form balls of cells. And so taking advantage of those assays, we looked to see if our cancer stem cells would function in this manner. And what we found is that we would get these, what we call tumor spheres, developed from our marker positive cells, but we didn't see them develop with our marker negative cells. We're still working on optimizing that assay, but what we find is if we take single triple positive marker cells and put them in a well, that about one of out of every 25 wells will form a tumor sphere. And so what that may mean is that our triple marker positive cells are just represent a highly enriched population of which a true cancer stem cell is encompassed within that, or perhaps we don't have the right gamish in the dish, if you will. We don't have some of the substances that might be produced by stroma or tissues or substances you might see in the tumor microenvironment to really allow these cells to grow to a greater degree. We envision that an assay like this could be used for high-throughput drug screening, and that's ultimately our goal. Now, a lot of drug companies ask me, well, can't we do this work in cell lines? And I don't know the right answer to this, and certainly it would be great if we could, because it would make life a lot easier. It's hard to get these xenografts up and going. And here I show you, we just took three commonly used pancreatic cancer cell lines and sorted for these different cell surface markers. And you can see, even with the cell lines, there is heterogeneous expression of these cell surface markers, such that there is a minority of these cells that are triple positive cells. But when we actually have started to do pilot experiments to see if we take these marker positive and negative cells and do sphere assays, the data we get is variable, and it doesn't seem to faithfully recapitulate what we see with our primary human tumors. And so I just tell people to be cautious with trying to extrapolate what they find with cell lines to what might be going on with the primary tumor. We are interested in seeing if the markers that we have are the best markers to try to identify cancer stem cells. And so we have looked at some other markers that are relevant in other systems, and this is all unpublished data. Three of the markers I'm going to show you today are listed here. ALDH, aldehyde dehydrogenase, has been identified as a cancer stem cell marker in breast cancer and colon cancer. CD133 is a marker in brain cancer and colon cancer. And then CMET we became interested in because there have been a couple papers that suggest it might be a putative stem cell marker in normal pancreatic cells. And here you can see the expression of these different markers in pancreatic cancer cells. And we were kind of interested to see that the expression of CMET was actually quite low in these cells. And there's a thinking that the lower the expression of a particular marker, that might be more representative of that marker identifying a cancer stem cell population. In a pilot experiment, sorting for these individual markers and then implanting them in mice, here you can see the data we obtained with the triple marker positive cells. And you can see that there is some enhanced tumor formation with all of these markers, but seem to be most prominent with the CMET sorted cells. So we were obviously interested in that. And then carrying that a little bit further, we can, and this is from three different tumors from three different patients, we see that the CMET positive cells seem to be at least as good, if not better, than our triple positive cells. And I think we're encouraged by that because it would certainly be helpful if we wanted to extrapolate all this to the clinic, if we could have a marker, a single marker that would be easy to sort for or even do immunohistochemistry for instead of having triple markers. Certainly that makes that more complicated. And so we're interested in pursuing whether CMET may be useful, both as a marker and a potential therapeutic target. Another thing we were interested in looking at is whether these cancer stem cells might have activation, if you will, of these pathways that have been thought to be important for stem cell function. And I list several of them here: the hedgehog signaling pathway, Notch. Steve Leacher is an expert on that. BMI-1, which is part of the polycomb gene family, Wnt signaling, or P10. And there is good evidence that dysregulation of these self-renewal pathways, if you will, leads to tumorigenesis in mouse models, and that they may also play a role in human cancers. And Here I list some of the cancers. There's nice work showing that hedgehog and notch signaling may be relevant for pancreatic cancer. So we did some quantitative RT-PCR using different sorted cell populations to look initially just at sonic hedgehog expression. And what we found is that we did have marked upregulation of sonic hedgehog in our cancer stem cells up to 46-fold with some increased expression in bulk cancer cells and marker negative cells. And we don't know for sure, but could hypothesize that perhaps this developmental signaling pathway is markedly upregulated in the cancer stem cell population. And then as the cells differentiate, that the pathway is still elevated, albeit at a much lower level. And we see a similar kind of thing for BMI-1, which is a protein that's been found to be important for self-renewal in almost every stem cell system or model system that's been looked at. This diagram was published in a review paper in Nature in 2001, and this is really why we care about all this stuff, is can we come up with better therapeutics to treat patients? And the thinking is that cancer stem cells are not responsive to standard therapy. So if this is our tumor with a population of cancer stem cells within it, and we give them our standard cocktails of chemotherapeutic and radiation, chemotherapeutic agents, radiation, that we see the tumor shrink, but if we don't hit the cancer stem cell, then the tumor will grow back. And certainly we see that in pancreatic cancer all the time. It's thought if we can identify agents that can specifically kill tumor stem cells, then the tumor will lose its ability to regenerate, and then ultimately the tumor would go away. Well, this is a nice theory, but really it's amazing to me how often this is talked about and how little data there is to support this model. There is a little bit of data showing that breast cancer stem cells and multiple myeloma cells may be resistant to chemotherapy. And there was a nice paper published by Jeremy Rich in Nature last year that suggests that brain cancer stem cells may be resistant to radiation. But certainly we didn't have any idea whether this might be true in pancreatic cancer. So we've started on some studies to try to figure that out. And these studies are still fairly preliminary, but I'll show you what data we have. And I think our data, at least the initial data we have, suggests that indeed these cells may be resistant to standard therapies. So if we take pancreatic tumor xenografts and we radiate them, how will it affect cancer stem cell number and function? So here, we started out giving a single dose of 8 gray, which certainly isn't a clinically relevant dose, but we thought was a reasonable starting point. And here you can see a very modest effect on tumor growth. If we then look at the cell populations within that tumor after we give that single dose of radiation here at different time points, what we see is actually that triple positive cell population is increased probably about sevenfold. And then it seems to go down after 3 weeks. And if you look at the individual markers, it seems like CD44 is probably the cell surface marker that's most responsible for that. What's going on here where the markers go up and then go down? You know, we don't know for sure, but presumably the cancer stem cell population enhances and then may differentiate with time, and that's why we see that curve over time. But how about if we give a more clinically relevant dose? So here's a dose that we might give to regular patients, and here's a regimen we give 2.5 gray per day times 4 to mice, and the results from that. And we see a similar kind of thing. It's not quite as dramatic, but we certainly see about a threefold increase in the cancer stem cells following this dose of radiation. So that shows that the numbers go up, but is that important functionally? Well, if we take these radiated and non-radiated tumors and then we disassociate them and take the same numbers of radiated and non-radiated cells, in this case 10,000, and plant them in mice, we can see that the radiated tumor cells really take off, suggesting that this enhanced number of cancer stem cells is functionally relevant and does enhance tumor growth. How about chemotherapy? We haven't done too much on this yet, but here you can see that giving gemcitabine to mice, if you look at the measurement of the triple positive cells over time, that we do see about a threefold increase at 3 weeks. And we're doing further studies with gemcitabine. So here are some of the questions I have about response or resistance to therapy. How is, if our cancer stem cells are resistant to therapy, how is this resistance achieved? Is there a more robust activation of the DNA damage response? Or if the damage inflicted is the same, but the ability to repair the damage is enhanced, and what signaling pathways or molecules might be altered? Does enrichment of cancer stem cells after radiation or chemotherapy actually occur in patients? Does the percentage of cancer stem cells within a tumor predict the sensitivity to chemotherapy or radiation? And perhaps we can figure out ways to develop agents that might preferentially sensitize cancer stem cells to chemotherapy or radiation. So how do we get at these questions? Some of the things we're doing are to try to define the mechanism by which cancer stem cells might be resistant to standard therapies, and we're looking at key signaling molecules and the DNA damage response, and we're interested in doing gene profiling and perhaps a systems biology approach to see which pathways may be differentially activated in the cancer stem cells before and after either radiation and chemotherapy to try to get a handle on that. We also are interested in determining if indeed these cancer stem cells are enriched in patients after chemotherapy and radiation. And one way I think we can get at that is in patients that we give neoadjuvant therapy to. So we patients who have locally advanced disease often get enrolled in clinical trials where they get chemotherapy and radiation. And so we can get biopsy samples of these patients' tumors before and after treatment to see if indeed the cancer stem cell population is enhanced. So what does this all mean in the big picture of how we think about therapeutics? Well, for a lot of clinical trials that we do, when we want to see if an agent is effective, we look at tumor shrinkage, and we think a tumor is responsive to an agent if we see tumor shrinkage of 50%. But if the cancer stem cells are a very small population of cells within the tumor, then we're not really going to see if agents are tackling the cancer stem cells. So we need to devise better methods to detect the effects of therapy on the cancer stem cell population. So how do we exactly do that? Are we going to have to sort biopsy samples? Is there a marker that we can use where we can use IHC as a surrogate? Which markers should we use? These are all, I think, important questions. There are lots of drug companies lining up to try to target cancer stem cells, if you will, but we really don't know what to measure yet. And so hopefully you all can help me figure out how to best approach that. And then another angle that's important for us to think about is you know, there are lots of similarities between cancer stem cells and normal stem cells. So can we come up with therapies that can effectively target cancer stem cells that won't have undue toxic effects on normal stem cells? Is this going to be possible? Well, I think the answer is we don't know, but I'm going to show you data from two papers that suggest it might be possible. So here's a paper that was published by Sean Morrison in Nature last year where they looked at the effect of P10, inactivation in leukemia. P10 is commonly inactivated in human leukemias, and it functions by inhibiting AKT signaling. And so what they did is they conditionally deleted the P10 gene in adult hematopoietic cells in mice. And what they found is that if you deleted the P10 gene, it actually led to depletion of normal stem cells and promoted the generation of cancer stem cells, leading to the development of leukemia. They then took mice that had well-developed leukemias, and then they treated the mice with rapamycin, which basically functioned to reverse the effect of the P10 deletion, and found that it actually inhibited the cancer stem cells and restored normal stem cell function. How this worked, they actually did not figure out, but certainly it provides provocative evidence that, in fact, you can selectively target the normal, differentially target the normal and cancer stem cells. And then this was a second paper published by John Dick's group where they again, looking at leukemias, where they noted that AML cancer stem cells had enhanced expression of CD44 on the cell surface of the cancer stem cell. So they targeted CD44 using a monoclonal antibody in the xenograft system. And what they found that is it selectively targeted the cancer stem cells but did not negatively affect the normal stem cells. And they found that it seemed like CD44 had important functions for the cancer stem cells. It wasn't just a cell surface marker, but was functional. It appeared to play a role in homing and engraftment of the cancer stem cells to the correct niche and in maintaining the cancer stem cells in a primitive state. So again, data that supports that perhaps we can differentially target cancer and normal stem cells. So this is just to summarize some of the data I've shown you that we have identified a cell populations that have enhanced tumorigenic potential and from human pancreatic cancer. Unlike breast cancer stem cells, the cells that we identified were ESA 44 and 24 positive, highlighting the fact that for all different kinds of cancers, you're really going to have to look at the particular cells within it and can extrapolate from other cancers. We showed that these cells have properties of self-renewal, ability to produce differentiated progeny, and have increased expression of developmental signaling pathways. We're trying to figure out the best way to measure cancer stem cells in biopsy samples of human cancer. And we're also in the midst of profiling these cells to try to get a better handle on what signaling pathways may be aberrantly regulated. I have a number of questions, but I'm just going to skip ahead for a second, just give credit for everybody that did this work. A bulk of the credit goes to Chen-Wei Li, who was the first author on the cancer research paper that really spearheaded this project in the lab, but there are lots of people that helped out. And I want to acknowledge Max Wish and Mats Lundgren, who's a DNA repair expert who's helping us out with the resistance studies, and then Mike Clark, who helped us launch into this field. And then these were some of the questions I thought that were worthwhile to stimulate discussion. One, are pancreatic cancer stem cells responsible for residual disease, therapeutic resistance, or recurrence? Two, can the findings with human pancreatic cancer stem cells be extrapolated to mouse models? We have a lot of mouse experts here, and I'm hoping you can help figure out how to do that. Do pancreatic cancers arise from a resident adult pancreatic stem cell? There's certainly a correlation between chronic inflammation and cancer. Is there a target stem cell that's expanded in the setting of chronic injury to the pancreas? And if so, does this contribute to tumorigenesis? And then importantly, and we haven't really gotten into this area yet, but what is the contribution of the tumor microenvironment to this whole process? So, with those questions, I guess we'll begin the discussion.
Let me go sit down here. So any questions of clarification? Before we go into the questions, just general questions about the presentation? Yes. Okay. Just.
And actually, can people identify who they are when they ask questions?
Mace Rothenberg from Vanderbilt. Dan, would you comment on the plasticity of stem cells? Are they static throughout the course of disease? Is there just a single stem cell population, or might there be multiple populations?
I think that's an excellent question. And actually, Sunil, or Dave Tuvis and I were talking about that last night. I have to presume there's a lot of plasticity in the system, and while I present them as a static entity, that they probably are plastic. We just don't really have a good way to assess that right now. I guess I'd also like to comment as I'm calling these cancer stem cells, but a lot of people worry about that terminology. Should we call them tumor-initiating cells, tumor-propagating cells? So I don't want everybody to get too hung up and worried just because I'm calling them a cancer stem cell. I think it's important for us all to recognize that we really don't know exactly what these cells are, except I will point out that the cells do appear to have self-renewal properties, and that is a property of stem cells. But I think exactly what they are, how plastic they are, that's something we still need to determine.
Just Thea Tilstey, UCSF. Just for a minute, if I could address the plasticity. In a normal biology and normal stem cells, they all start with the same DNA, but how they express their different organ specificity or plasticity is through epigenetics. Mm-hmm. And that's probably a major role that's happening here.
Mm-hmm. Look, our table gets a microphone and nobody else gets it. Terry Bretnall, beautiful talk, Diane. My question is, and it goes to the plasticity, when you take these tumor stem cells and you inject them into the mice and you look at the tumors that they form, there's, you know, is there a microenvironment around that tumor? Is there the fibrosis and the...
The mouse fibroblasts infiltrate into that tumor.
Do you know that they're from the mouse?
Yeah, we know they're from the mouse. We are interested in looking at the interaction of these cells with pancreatic fibroblasts. So along those lines, we have actually isolated primary pancreatic tumor fibroblasts, which actually take a long time to get going, but we just now have gotten them going, and we're going to immortalize them and look at what role the interaction of those cells with these cancer stem cells may have. I do think there's something very unique about the milieu of the pancreas, and, you know, you can establish a pancreatic cancer in the sub-Q and treat it with agent X and you'll get tumor shrinkage, but I think those cells are going to be a lot more resistant in the pancreas where you have this extensive fibrosis and interaction of other cell types there.
I wanted to follow up on, this is Tony Hollingsworth from Epley Institute. I wanted to follow up on Terry's question, actually. I was going to ask the same question. Have you really confirmed that you have no human fibroblasts when you do in your xenograft model? Have you ever gone in with human markers against, for example, human ribosomal proteins, or there are different specific markers you can look at and confirm that there are none that are there?
You know, we haven't, but I think that's an excellent suggestion. And it may be, I don't know if any from the Hopkins group can come on that. Is Ralph? My understanding is that the fibroblasts kind of go away with the xenografts from my readings of your work. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't think you can say that there aren't any.
Yeah.
The vast majority of the fibroblasts are the
mouse
Yeah.
Last question, please.
Yeah. Okay, Tim Yateman, Moffitt Cancer Center. Two questions. One, what's the proliferative index of the stem cell? And do they simply just have a very low proliferative index? That's why standard chemotherapy, the resistance to standard chemotherapy. And the second question relates to
Let me take the first. Okay. When we just do simple cell cycle analysis, we don't see any significant differences between the cancer stem cells and the normal stem cells. But presumably, it's thought that they're not cycling the same way that the differentiated cancer cells are, so they're more resistant to standard therapies.
And the second question related to osteopontin and CD44. We know that osteopontin regulates CD44. We know osteopontin's a big player in metastasis. So have you looked at that at all?
We haven't. I think there's lots of biology that could be worked out with CD44. And, in fact, there are interactions of c-MET and CD44. And we're interested in that, but we haven't gotten into it yet.
Diane Selwyn, Vickers, Minnesota. When you reimplant the stem cells, obviously they reproduce and grow, but they actually produce non-surface marker cells. What's the value in the relationship to the non-marker cells to the stem cells? Are they necessary for the tumor growth, and are they important?
Well, they're not necessary for the tumors to develop, because although there is, when we double sort these cells, there's probably a contamination of 2-3%, which you just can't get away from. But if we take the, relatively pure, marker-positive cell population and plant them in mice, as few as 100 cells, they can form the tumors. Is there some kind of autocrine relationship going on? It's possible, but we don't know. Yeah?
I have a more simplistic question. Jordan Berlin, Vanderbilt. And that's the question where you showed that the radiation gemcitabine, there was this proliferation of the stem cells upon administering these. Has anybody looked at stem cells in tumors that are actually sensitive, such as the leukemia stem cells and the radiation? Do you see the same effects, or is this something where the tumors are more consistently resistant?
I haven't seen any data published or not on that topic, but certainly you would hypothesize that if a cancer stem cell from you know, one type of cancer was more radiosensitive, that there were inherent differences to some of our findings with cancers that are radiation resistant. You would think that the cancer stem cells are different, brain cancer, prostate cancer, but that's not been, assessed yet. Ralph?
I have two questions. One is, it seems fundamental to this is the issue of reversibility. If a non-stem cell, cancer stem cell, can revert to a stem cell, then it really seems a moot point in examining the stem cells, because you can get rid of all the stem cells, and if the non-cancer stem cells can revert to stem cells, then treating the stem cell population wouldn't make a difference. And I have a second question after you answer that. So is there any evidence that the non-stem cell population cannot revert to stem cells?
Yes. Well, we don't see that the marker negative cells revert back to marker positive cells in these type of assays. You know, I guess it gets to the question of, you know, cell of origin. You know, there's are the tumors developing from stem cells, progenitor cells, completely differentiated cells that then undergo dedifferentiation and develop stem cell properties? You know, don't know the answer to that. But clearly these cells are different. These cells that have these cell surface markers, they're much more tumorigenic. Their ability to form tumors, at least in the artificial system of an immunodeficient mice, is markedly enhanced. And so I think, you know, my feeling is it's worth pursuing to see whether these would be good targets. But I think in the end we have to do the experiments to see if this all bears out to give us more effective therapies.
And my second question is, can you think of an experiment that would fundamentally test the hypothesis on whether these are stem cells or just tumorigenic cells and the other cells aren't viable? What would be the single experiment that would prove or disprove the stem cell hypothesis?
I think the single experiment is you take a single cell and you can generate the heterogeneity of the tumor. You take a single putative, you know, purified cancer stem cell and you can regenerate the tumor. That's how they proved that the recently identified stem cell in the breast was truly, you know, the initiating stem cell. They took a, you know, single cell and can regenerate the gland.
That actually is the normal stem cell, you know, the reconstitution of a tissue is the normal definition or normal test of a stem cell.
You know, that just relevant to your question, there was a recent experiment done by Gil Smith that was rather remarkable, where he took a cell from a different organ. It was a non-committed cell, put it into a de-epithelialized mammary gland, and got a regeneration of the mammary gland. So there was enough incoming signals from the surrounding mesenchyme to instruct that cell to do the right thing. So we're looking at an operational definition mm-hmm. of a cellular behavior.
That gets away from Ralph. I have to make a little commentary. It gets away from Ralph's point, which Max came to Sloan Kettering and showed the non-breast stem cells and said, look at this morphology. They're screwed up. They're aneuploid. They look like they're about to die. These are the normal differentiated cells. And I think the alternative hypothesis here is cells going through very disordered, dysregulated mitoses, which is a lot of cancer cells, no longer proliferate and have no proliferative potential. And this, and I think that's part of your point. You have a lot of sick cells in cancer that develop lots of genomic instability and lots of death. You get 10% apoptosis in cancer populations. You do not see that in normal cells. So the question, I think, is an important one. Are these stem cells, or are these just cells healthy enough to keep propagating the tumor?
Well, and healthy enough in the context that when you transplant them, as you said, you treat with collagenase, you remove their normal stromal milieu. Mm-hmm. And so you're really asking for the ability of a cell that can grow outside of its normal mm-hmm. environment to grow in a mouse. As you've said, it was mm-hmm. important to do it in the context of a pancreas, but still that's not normal. I mean, the integrin connections are going to be different. The extracellular matrix is going to be different. And, of course, this cancer was growing in an abnormal matrix to mm-hmm. begin with, and it evolved to respond to that. So I think what we're doing is we're looking at an operational definition of a cell that's able to form in an ectopic environment under abnormal conditions. And whether that relates, and you pointed it out very importantly, whether that relates to the cell of origin of the cancer, whether that's really regenerating that cancer after treatment, is a critical one. So Dave Tuvison and other people who are doing mouse models, can you say whether if you generate an autochthonous model in the mouse, can you fractionate those cells and get the same kind of behavior if you inject them into an immunocompetent animal? Do you get the same kind of thing? So maybe it's an
appropriate. So maybe I can make a comment here. So I've talked to Dave and Sunil about this, and we're planning on looking in the mouse models, the KRAS P53 mice, but there's so many crossed lines that you can't actually. Well, maybe we can now, but take one of those tumors and actually grow it in a normal strain of mice. So Sunil is back breeding back onto a pure line, so we could just take those tumors and do the same thing in mice, where you're going to get away from the issue that you don't have them in the normal tumor microenvironment. And I don't know if you want to, either of you want to comment on that, or
Can I?
Let's go over here for a moment. Basically,
those experiments.
Excuse me. We must capture your ideas, Eris. Would you give them the microphone?
Neil,
you want me to go ahead?
As Diane describes, those experiments are, in fact, currently underway. I can say that in the immunocompromised mice, you can recapitulate this kind of physiology and this sort of behavior. But the important question on whether you can do it in an immunocompetent mouse, I think, is a relevant one, and that's underway.
Nabil Bardisi from MGH. And just along these lines, I think an experiment that would have been nice to see would be ESA-positive cells that were specifically negative for CD24 and CD44. Can you comment on that, results of that experiment? So the ESA,
the tumorigenicity of those cells?
Yes, ESA-positive but explicitly negative for
right.
the other markers.
So, you know, I think most of us in this field think these markers are identified in an enriched population, if you will. So I don't think we have a pure cancer stem cell in hand. So I think that within that ESA, we do see some slightly increased tumorigenicity with ESA-positive cells, and the thinking is that, you know, within that population, there's, you know, there's some enrichment of... Yeah.
I'm going to repeat that. So
okay.
If you explicitly depleted the CD24 positive cells and or the CD44 positive cells from the ESA positive pool, which mm-hmm. is actually quite a large proportion, right, of
mm-hmm.
the
it is.
And the various other depletions of one of the three. I was wondering if you could comment on
that.
Well,
with sorting, we, you know, essentially deplete it, but we still have a small amount of contamination. Did you have an idea of how to, you know, have 100% depletion of these markers?
Well, just in the paper, you just didn't show that experiment, which was ESA positive, CD24 negative. So you do a negative sort,
mm-hmm.
and then you'd, or a positive sort and then a negative.
Basically, are trying to get rid of the non- epithelial cells, right?
That
there is a positive.
Some people have used.
Well,
ES.
No, that would only be the okay. So that you're
24 negative.
Right, but you're trying with the ESA positive would be that it was the epithelial cell rather than anything else that would have been in the tumor.
Exactly, but of that population, if you depleted these two markers, the CD24, then do you lose the tumorigenicity? Because the CD40, the ESA enriches globally. Presumably the epithelial cells.
Right. You know, honestly, I can't remember that data, but
sure.
I'll have to look back at that.
Can I ask a naive therapeutic question?
Sure.
If the issue here is that we're hitting the non-stem cells and not the stem cells, and the stem cells are a small population of the tumor responsible for repopulation,
mm-hmm.
that predicts that we get massive responses and then the tumor comes back?
Well, I think we see a variety of responses for the patients, right? So
we don't see a variety of responses in the patients. We see no responses.
No, that's actually not correct. We do see some tumors have partial responses where we treat with chemotherapy or radiation, and we see some tumor shrinkage.
What percent of patients have a partial response to gemcitabine?
Jordan, where are you? He'll give you an accurate number.
7 to 10%.
Well, right. For example,
so, 90 to 93% of patients don't respond. So at best, the therapy doesn't work because it's not hitting the stem cells and it's not hitting the non-stem cells. This is not AML or even small cell where the tumor disappears and then comes back. This is a tumor, like many tumors, mm-hmm. renal cell, gastric, et al., where nothing happens.
That's right.
Because of course,
it is not.
Okay, let's take a couple more questions on this topic, and then we're going to shift if it's all right.
Tumor does not shrink in terms of radiographic dimensions. When you actually biopsy the tumor before and afterwards, the percentage of that mass, that is tumor cells, goes down significantly, and then the serous fibrotic reaction really occupies a much higher percentage of that mass.
I'll give you an example of that. We have, for patients that have locally advanced pancreatic cancer, we treat them with chemotherapy and radiation, and then we'll go in and do a resection, and we have some patients that we have a complete pathologic response where the pathologist can't find any viable tumor cells. Maybe, Ralph, you can come in on that.
That number of patients, look, I do take care of patients rarely. That is vanishingly small in most solid tumors. It happens. It occurs. You can see various nebulae occur and supernovas, but it doesn't generally happen. And if it's 10% or 2% stem cells that's responsible for this resistance alone, that ain't what's going on.
So, you know, one thing that this is a really great discussion, and I want to thank all the questioners and Diane. But we would like to, I think, try to get to some deliverables from this. I mean, there is a debate here, and I think that there could be a point where we say, okay, what is the critical experiment that needs to be done to really critically evaluate the hypothesis? How do we either prove or disprove, take advantage of this concept, and how do we move forward? So Greg is going to attempt to write something down.
That's not what I told him.
But it's what I'm – but we need to – yeah. So what we would want to do is we're going to have to summarize some essential points that are critical to move forward on very soon. Let's continue the – how much time do we have?
Oh, 45 minutes. We've got lots of time.
How much more time do we have?
45 minutes.
Oh, great. Okay. So let's continue this on. And then I think what it's going to do is it's going to distill down into a few points that are really essential to move forward on. So, Neil, do you want to restate what the issue is, and then we can contemplate later about how to go forward?
Well, I think the data is very interesting across the field. The two assertions are we don't cure cancers because we don't hit stem cells, which Bill Sellers now would dispute for CML and Gleevec, and resistance, and that's what resistance is due to. Another assertion is we need stem cell specific assays to talk about how therapy works. Okay, and you might counter that argument. You might by saying effective stem cell therapy should give you stable disease with regression later, slow regression later as you deplete the stem cells, so that we can test the hypothesis in traditional clinical trials. One might argue that. But I think for me the first question is continues in the other questions here, first validating the hypothesis and then directing oneself toward the therapeutic implication.
So I didn't actually get, because Greg was asking me some questions, MACE, you were disagreeing with Neil that when you give these therapies, you actually do get a substantial tumor response. I think I was hearing that. And Neil was saying, well, no, you don't. And the difference was between reduction of the tumor mass and actually what's going on at the cellular level?
Yes.
And your contention is that you actually are killing off a large number of the cells?
Yes.
But there must, according to Diane and others, be some refractory population that is causing them to grow back. And actually, I just want to make a comment relative to Jordan's point that Barney Clarkson pointed this out many, many years ago in leukemias, where he was doing radiation experiments, and he always found a resistant subpopulation that he thought defied the laws of physics, that, you know, you just weren't hitting with complete effectiveness using the radiation doses and schedules. So he concluded at that time that there must be a refractory subpopulation that now we might call a cancer stem cell. Bill?
I think you just
You need a microphone.
Where are they?
I'll be right back. We're going out of turn.
Well, while he's doing it, I think the two fundamental questions, though, that really haven't been answered to my satisfaction is, can you distinguish between a cancer stem cell and simply a viable cancer cell?
Yes.
Right.
And the second is, can you show that the non-stem cell population cannot revert to stem cells?
Right.
But doesn't that...
I think in Drosophila, for instance, Alan Spradling has shown in normal stem cells, when they leave the stem cell niche, they can revert. They can, when they go back in the stem cell niche, can revert to stem cells. And if that's the same for cancer cells, where likely it is even more so, then targeting that stem cell population, if the non-stem cells can revert to stem cells, it does not form a valuable therapeutic approach.
Unless you figure out how that happens and prevent that.
But wasn't one of...
Is the cancer stem cell a mutated cell?
Right. Well, we...
Wait, what did you say?
Well, we know that these... Well, we don't know whether they... I mean, you even stated, Diane, that part of the cancer cell hypothesis was that it is a cell that takes on stem cell properties, or it's a normal stem cell that has...
Undergoes mutation.
Change. So, and we don't know that, do you?
Well, we know these cells have KRAS mutations. That's all we've looked at so far. We haven't done a complete mutational analysis.
Well,
of them.
I think in AML it actually looks more like a proliferative progenitor, right, that's regained self-renewal properties.
So. Yes,
I just want to comment on Dr. Rosen and Dr. Rothenberg. I think there are two potential differences, that when you talk about a stem cell population and resistance, is it the same for the primary tumor in the pancreas as it may be for a metastasis in the liver? And so are you dealing with really two different completely different situations, one in the primary that you may have a certain responsiveness but a lot of fibrosis and less shrinkage as compared to what goes on in a metastasis as far as how many stem cells are there and so on. And the last point, and mm-hmm. then we'll pass the microphone, I've been a little cautious in trying to extrapolate data from liquid tumors and apply it to solid tumors. I know a lot of work was done in the early 70s looking at liquid tumors and dose response curves in leukemia cell lines, and that got applied to solid tumors. I'm not sure it applies. So just my question is, can you apply what you see in leukemias to pancreatic cancer?
So let me just comment on your first comment about primaries versus metastasis, and do they act differently? Well, the reality is we can't get pieces of primary and metastasis from the same patient because you never end up, getting both of those specimens from one patient. If you're doing an operation, you're just going to get the primary. If the patient's got a metastasis, it's incredibly difficult to get a piece of. You might get a little piece of the met, but you have to really push to get IRB approval to get, an adequate piece of the primary and the met. Now, I know that Tony has his rapid autopsy system, and so if we get to a point where we can try to answer some of this with, paraffin blocks or, with staining, we can do that. But, for a lot of these analyses, you need fresh tumor, and so that's a real hard thing with pancreatic cancer. As for regards to liquid versus solid, I think... I'm not hard set that this is, where this is going. I think we just have to empirically test these hypotheses and see where it takes us. And I don't think we can predict the answers, whether solid tumors are different than, leukemias or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The conversation has been productively provocative, which I think is the goal of the meeting, and I think the fact that we run into the organized, moderated session is good. That means we're actually alive, and I think keeping this debate going is important. I'm going to try to give 3 points that you can write down, so I'll try to make them succinctly, and some of that will be reiterating the comments made previously. I think an important point is the dynamicism of this entity, right? Is it dynamic? You early on, you took a question about, is this a static event in time? and it goes forward like a pyramid, or is it actually loops coming back on itself? There was an experiment done by Linda Chin and Rudy Yanish where they took the nuclei of a melanoma cell line, and they did nuclear transport. Transfer. Mm-hmm. I've transported from a continent. They did nuclear transfer. They made an ESL from which they actually made mice, chimeric mice, albeit, but they made chimeric mice. And so this ESL harboring a melanoma nucleus, which had multiple genomic alterations, gave rise to cells in every tissue of that mouse. The mouse ran around the cage, ate food, looked okay, lived, died of cancer, multiple types of cancer, but proved in one single experiment that reprogramming by neighboring cells, mm-hmm. whatnot, plays a monster role in the ability of modulating the behavior of a, quote, cancer cell. All by itself, that one experiment. And that speaks about development, about tumorigenesis, anything you want to talk about. So the non-cell autonomous effects on the cancer cell, I think, raised its head in bold fashion, you know, in that one experiment. And so the dynamicism, which many people ask you about, how do you know that the ESA positive CD24, CD44 positive cells are the road to Rome, or that in fact multiple cells at any one time in the day,
right.
or week are CD24, 44, ESA positive or MET positive or whatever. That experiment really has never been done, I don't think.
Well, so I think the only way to do this is in a mouse, because you can't do it in the human. And that's why I think in the end we have to revert back to the mouse to try to answer these questions, solve some of these answers, and then try to go back to the human.
So you'll have, you know, Sunil will moderate a session in a little bit, so he can give you his, you know, feedback on that, and Nabil does similar experiments in mouse models. So one, that's one point. Is it dynamic or is it static? The second point Thea brought up, which is how do we know that this is a, quote, monoclonal situation in a cancer? In fact, it's likely a polyclonal situation, or oligoclonal at least. So Nelly Polyak had a paper in Cancer Cell not so long ago getting into this issue. How do we know that the CD24 low, 44 high cells exist as a one entity in a breast cancer? In fact, she showed that there were at least several populations of cells, mm-hmm. which by either genetic or epigenetic means collectively create a cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a cooperation, a coordination, an interdependence of many different cell types, which give you a mass, which result in a clinical diagnosis, et cetera. And in pancreas cancer, I think we have pretty good evidence that this is a extremely genomically unstable cancer. There are multiple clones at any one time in any one tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And so try to parse that out into a leukemia problem, maybe even be much harder than this. And so I guess one question for you and for people that study this topic is, how do we know that this is a, quote, monoclonal problem? And in fact, it may be a cooperation, a collaboration, a conspiracy of many different cell types, of many different genetic zip codes that actually cause the cancer. And some of them may be genomic alterations, even in those stromal cells that, you know, we mm-hmm. sort of at a distance talked about. The third point is actually the simplest point that I have to make, so be truly succinct.
Well, I think it's like the panin issue. You know, Ralph did all the work showing there are panins, and we hypothesized they're relevant for pancreatic cancer. And I think that observation in human samples was important. And then you made mice that validated it, that it was relevant for pancreatic cancer. So
the third point is actually really succinct, which is, it seems to me that the assays used to describe these cells are truly survival assays.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what they are. You're asking who survives. And who survives best, of course, makes cancer the fastest. So how do we know that we're merely not describing the population that survives an oikos, that survives being torn out of its environment, thrown through a fax sorter at the end of, you know, mm-hmm. it takes a few hours to do this experiment, no matter how talented you are.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, these are the ones that actually survive. So if you did a proper anoikos assay, you could show that in cell culture, on the same day you start the experiment, that, yeah, these are the population that actually survive compared to, say, in the beginning of the experiment. And when you put them in a mouse, the surviving cells obviously make a tumor much better than the ones that don't survive. And then when you treat with gemcitabine or radiation, well, guess what? You're basically studying the same topic.
Well, I think it gets to the issue of self-renewal, which is the basic inherent property by which we define stem cells. And that's, you know, that's what differentiated from just from cells that have an enhanced tumorigenicity, if you will, but that gives them that, you know, stem cell label, if you will. And Jeff, you want to comment? Or
Actually, Dave, I wanted to get back to the point that you brought up about polyclonality. So the idea would be there that the reason for the resistance of pancreatic cancers to therapies is because they're so polyclonal, either because of their frank genomic rearrangements or because those rearrangements even instill further epigenetic instability and consequently different expression programs, that no matter what drug you're going to give, there's going to be a large fraction of cells within that big mass, because it's detected late, that are going to be refractory to therapy. So the question is, is that situation in pancreatic cancer very fundamentally different from other cancers where, in fact, treatment can be more successful? Or if you really look at it with equivalent care, do you see an equivalent amount in late-stage tumors of such heterogeneity? If the answer to that is yes, then the reason for the refractoriness of pancreatic cancers can't be due to just that intrinsic heterogeneity.
Yeah. No, I don't want to speak to that. I just have a separate.
But Jeff, you know, that is looking at the end product cell as opposed to the so-called cancer stem cell.
But we're talking about.
And so, what is the therapeutic target?
Successful therapies, right? That's what I'm asking about.
So I guess one of the questions is, can you have a successful therapy if you can't get to an early cell type, because you're going to keep regenerating or reseeding the tumor, right?
But I think the discussion here is whether, in fact, that is the reason, that in other words, you're going to kill off all these cells except for this subpopulation, versus the idea that you may kill many cells, mm-hmm. but there's still enough heterogeneity that even if you kill 90% of the cells, you've got 10% left, they have enough instability, those cells are going to grow back. I mean, you know, three generations, that's all it's going to take. So that's really what I think the issue is.
I would want to make a point about the definition of a cancer stem cell, though. If you merely define it as self-renewal, then the issues of specifically treating that population become less important. I think you really want to define it as the ability to self-renew and having very specific properties that are targetable.
No, I think so that's true. That's but I was highlighting why it's not just a tumorigenicity assay.
Yeah, I had one in terms of deliverables. I think that with regard to some of these different populations, it would be really important to use every tool that is available to purify them as much to homogeneity as possible, and do a very thorough gene array proteomic analysis, and in particular an analysis of basically every known oncogene status that one can do, because then you can at least get some idea of whether there is a progression or a staging, and how far it goes back towards a normal cell or not.
So that's
a deliverable that you could really put down.
It is a deliverable.
Chart.
It's something we're working on. You know, part of the problem with doing those things are the number of cells that you have to work with are incredibly small. And so, you know, one way to advance this field, I think, is for programs to develop xenograft programs, and because in the end you're limited by the amount of fresh tumor that you have.
That's true, but you know, there depends on how you set up the interrogation, because if you look for the known, Tony, you can help here, whatever the known number of mutated kinases are, which is a finite, it's basically known, it's somewhere close to 100, right? 150 is a specifically known number, and they're all identified. And if you add up the number of known likely mutated oncogenes, you could use even a single cell via amplification to interrogate just the oncogenic population without trying to look at every single gene. So you can do it from low cell numbers if you're targeted. If you want to look at everything, then you need more material. So There may be ways to do it.
Well, whoever wants to help me do that, or whoever else is running the field, I'd be glad to, because we've run into, you know, it's been hard to try to do these things with the low number of cells that we have.
I think it's doable. Thea, yes.
May I bring up another question, another point, though? These cancer stem cells, with the markers you have, what we've seen, those same markers are actually found in the normal human pancreatic duct. We've done microarray analysis of the sorted human ducts. I mean, albeit we have mainly the small ducts and the central Asner cells, but these markers, we have not gone back and done the immunostaining to see that each one is a triple stain. But all three of these markers that you're using are very, very highly expressed in the population. So are these really a separate cell, or is this a sort of a aggregation of stem cells that are just reacting also to something different in the environment?
Well, you know, we've tried to do staining with these markers, but there's a lot of background. They're not very good, and so we haven't really got a good answer. And again, you'd have to do triple staining. And then there's also a question is whether central Asner cell is really, you know, a cell of origin for these tumors. So I think it's something we have to look at. But, you know, and we've also used a different technique, which is cell sorting, and there's different antibody concentrations and how you set the gates, and so it's, you know, it's not exactly the same system to try to look at these things. When we actually take normal pancreas and sort for these triple positive cells, we get about 1 in 10,000 cells that express these triple cell markers, but we haven't been able to really collect any number of them to do anything with them yet. But.
How about it? Can we just go over here?
That's a very simple question for you, Dan.
Yeah.
Only one part question,
okay.
By the way. Given time, do these triple positive cells also develop metastases in exactly the same kind of distribution you
would expect? So if we take these cells and put them in the pancreas, and then over time, yes, they will develop tumors that have marker positive and negative cells and will metastasize. Now, is it these specific cancer stem cells? Some people think that it's just the cancer stem cells that metastasize, but we don't know that, and there is actually no data out there that has addressed that question.
If we take the slightly more optimistic approach and argue that these are in fact the cells that might give rise to the resistant population, as you pointed out, this is a common property of all stem cells being resistant to genotoxic stress. Mm-hmm. So the question that I would like to put up, again, in terms of deliverable, is there a reason to assume that their resistance is conferred by a mechanism that is entirely different from other stem cells? That is to say, what's the advantage of us hunting for the pancreatic cancer stem cell if the property of being resistant is going to be a common property that is going to be due to some major defect in DNA damage response or something along these lines? So why is it important for us to study the pancreatic stem cell?
Well, because we're trying to have, you know, therapies to treat pancreatic cancer, and we don't know if the mechanisms of resistance are similar or different to other cancers. We don't know if the mechanisms of resistance are similar or different from normal stem cells. And the only way.
So my question is, if anybody took in the past, and maybe someone in the audience here know, breast cancer stem cell versus brain tumor stem cells, and
so there's
compare them with respect to resistance to therapy.
There's very little published data on this topic. Two papers looking at cancer stem cells and resistance to chemotherapy, one with breast cancer, one with multiple myeloma, suggesting that the cancer stem cells identified by the markers relevant for those cancers were resistant to chemotherapy, more resistant than the non-cancer stem cells. In the paper I referred to by Jeremy Rich, where he showed that CD133 positive cells appear to have a very distinct response to radiation that conferred those cells markedly resistant to radiation by alterations in the DNA repair system. That's all the data that is out there right now. So it's just, you know, something that's going to need to be investigated.
And I will just
clearly
like,
important. Right.
Just like to quickly follow up on Susan's comment about the normal cell, so I can just tell you, and again, this is not published data, but one of the puzzling things that we have seen now for quite a long time is that if you just take, and this is mouse cells, I don't know if Susan tried it in the human, but if you just take normal mouse ductal epithelium, these cells are significantly more resistant to any kind of stress that you put on these cells. So there is...
Compared to what cells?
Compared to acinar cells, mm-hmm. compared to other mammary mm-hmm. epithelial cells. Mm-hmm. So there must be, or there might be, something very unique about this population in general mm-hmm. that confers on them this resistant behavior. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it could be that it's the combination of the subpopulation plus the population at large.
So I'd like to speak about towards this issue of whether these cancer stem cells are a dynamic or a static population, sort of the question that Ralph raised and Dave proposed as question number one, and suggest that that may indeed be a question that can be experimentally addressed. And so the question is, when you radiate these tumors and you see an expanded population of triple-positive cells, is that due to expansion of cells that were mm-hmm. triple-positive prior to treatment, mm-hmm. or is it due to marker-negative cells attaining this triple-positive state? And those kinds of questions about...
So that I can answer. Mm-hmm. So we have radiated marker-negative cells, and we do not see them revert to okay. marker-positive cells. If you look at these people, you look at these tumors, you see that there is apoptosis of the marker negative cells. And so are what we're seeing is just the percentage of enrichment is just due to dying off of the marker negative cells, or is radiation actually cause proliferation of the marker positive cells? And we're trying to sort that out right now.
So as one example of a more general set of questions, that's a problem that's frequently addressed in developmental biology mm-hmm. using Creelox lineage labeling. So for instance, if we had tamoxifen inducible Creelon that could be activated within that population and to pulse them and their descendants with mm-hmm. a heritable genetic label,
yeah.
you could ask questions about whether that label was ever diluted by an influx mm-hmm. of originally negative cells. And so it gets to a question I realize I don't know how upregulated expression of these surface antigens is accomplished. Is it accomplished through transcriptional upregulation, as Susie suggested based on her microarray studies, such that it might be amenable to the development of Creelox-based methods for labeling mm-hmm. this lineage? Is that information known, and should a deliverable be developing the technology that allows the indelible labeling of these populations in a specific window of time to study how cells move in and out of mm-hmm. Of this lineage?
I mean, I completely agree with you. I think lineage tracing is going to be the way to get at some of these questions. With regards to the developmental question, I don't know the answer to that, but does anybody here that's any normal stem cell biologists here? I don't know the answer to as far as these markers and their role in development.
But specifically, how is their upregulated expression regulated?
I honestly don't know how well that has been looked at.
Is the recapitulation of the primary tumor in these xenografts? In other words, what fraction of the xenografts mature have stem cell positive populations, and how faithful is that recapitulate the ability to measure response to therapy in the xenografts in the mouse?
So we haven't looked at response to therapy, but that paper I was alluding to by Manuel Hidalgo, Clinical Cancer Research, published last summer, shows that if you take the parent tumor and you look at treat it with a therapeutic, and I want to say maybe it was gemcitabine or 5-FU, and then you look at tumors that are passage up to 6 times, the response to the cancer agent was quite similar. With regards to expression of these markers with that the percentage we see in the primary tumor versus with passaging, that percentage is maintained with passaging. We've studied them up to 4 passages.
A small fraction
It's a small fraction. The percentage of, you know, the cancer stem cell fraction, if you will, that we see in the primary tumor does vary from patient to patient, depending on which marker we're looking at, but that percentage is preserved within that in, that tumor with passaging, from the primary to the passage xenograft. Because you would anticipate if it was a, you know, a marker representing a progenitor cell that and it didn't have the ability to self-renew, that that percentage would not be maintained with passaging.
Right. So, Diane, just a simple therapeutic question. If in fact, after exposure to chemotherapy or to radiation, you're expanding this population of so-called stem cells, does that suggest that neoadjuvant therapy is actually a bad thing? Is that something you want to do then, therapeutically?
It's a good question. I talk to my oncology colleagues, and I question that. And I think it's an important question, and I think we have to deter. You know, we have to pursue these studies more and get a feel for whether, you know, neoadjuvant therapy is not a good thing, or if it's a bad thing, is a good thing or a bad thing. But I mean, currently we use neoadjuvant therapy for locally. There are clinical trials where you use neoadjuvant therapy for resectable lesions, and that's quite controversial. But for locally advanced lesions where, you know, the thinking is that perhaps that represents a tumor that, from a biologic standpoint, is somewhat more advanced, may already be, you know, systemic cancer cells. And in some cases, we're trying to, you know, downsize it so that we can resect it. You know, I think that's a reasonable approach, but certainly, you know, the kind of data that we see, it raises that concern.
So just the data in breast and lung cancer, locally advanced, is in a population of patients, it's a good thing. That does not contradict anything you said. There may be patients where it's a bad thing. But I also have to say, stimulating the tumor with cytotoxics may stimulate, it doesn't necessarily differentially kill the resistant population. It may stimulate whatever you're calling marker-positive stem cells with no real partition question there. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at the difference between those. But as a pop, so there are well-known trials, which Mace can quote better than I can, in lung cancer and breast cancer where neoadjuvant works better than traditional therapy.
I've been asked to break in here. So forgive me for asking to curtail discussion at this point for the following important reason. There's so much energy and so many good ideas coming from this room. I'd like you to think about the following. And we're going to give you 10 minutes to discuss this question at each of your tables. And then in the remaining 10 minutes, we'll come up to see if there's any consensus that can be arrived at. And we can reevaluate our answer to this question at the end of the meeting. Here's the question. PanCAN is writing a new strategic plan. And they're going to have a lot of money. And we're going to also force the Congress to give even more money to pancreatic cancer research. What are the three essential areas, three essential questions to focus on to move this aspect of the field forward to make a substantial difference? What are the three essential questions to focus on, to have money to fund? Okay? So discuss that at each of your tables. You've heard a lot of discussion. Diana's given a great introduction. We hope that all the talks will be exactly this way, stimulate a lot of discussion, so that we can try to come up to resolutions, to identify resolutions to controversies, to move things forward, and ultimately, how can we translate the basic information into earlier methods of detection and better methods of treatment? That's the mantra.
10 minutes at your tables and reach some consensus.
So this is not just relationships with stem cells, but this is on
No.
Right now, Mace, let's just focus on what we've been listening to, and then you'll get to do it for each of the topics that are raised.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Need one person from each table. I'm going to ask for one question. We probably won't get around to all the tables, but we'll get a good start here. So let's start over here with the first question.
Thanks, Bill.
Okay, so we have a lot of ideas, but we have one, I think, that we can tell you quickly. And you've heard it already. So it's explore the plasticity of identified cancer stem cells and non-cancer stem cells using human material and animal models. Full stop. Trace cell fate to determine these characteristics in the model systems. Stop. Okay, so that's our first point. You guys, where are your writers? Okay, so we're supposed to have two others, and we will have a group method to do this. Absolutely.
We didn't really finish formulating our questions completely. We had more debate. So we think the question of cell heterogeneity among stem cell populations hasn't been adequately addressed. And so in particular, it seems logical, since there are the environments can impact the stem cells. So different metastatic sites, for example, you could imagine that different capacity stem cells would be resident there. If you're going to try to come up with one therapy for one cell, it's unlikely to work in patients with advanced disease, because there's going to be more of those populations present. So so we thought that addressing that question of heterogeneity, in that I think it's similar to plasticity in some ways, just perhaps slightly framed in slightly different questions, is one issue. And we just had a comment that it's sort of easier to address questions of therapeutics using their premalignant lesions. So maybe looking at mouse models with Pan-N3s and that sort of thing to really ask the question of what the contribution of the cell type is to that, instead of looking at models with advanced disease, would give more insight. So just a comment, I think, along those lines. And other points? Remind me, Theo.
The basic question about whether the increased lethality in pancreatic cancer is... what proportion is due to the inability to detect it early versus some intrinsic property of pancreatic tumor cells of being more resistant of therapy?
So we focused on debate as well, but a couple common themes came out. One was the importance of working on the hypothesis in the mouse models using lineage tracing in the genetic models that have been created. And so as a way to verify these cells or disprove the idea of these cells in pancreatic cancer. And we thought very separately that therapy or outcomes related to this population seemed a little premature. However, the targeting of pathways related to stem cells are established could be pursued if the context is understood. So focusing on the pathways that we know are relevant to the cancers, but possibly independent of outcomes related to the subpopulation.
So the other table stole already a couple of our ideas, the genetic mouse models and the focused pathways. We still had a couple of additional ideas, one related to what is the role of tumor cancer cell dormancy in relation to the stem cell hypothesis. And the other one was, is it really true that neoadjuvant chemoradiotherapy expands the stem cell population? And if that's the case, why is there a group of patients that responds to neoadjuvant chemoradiotherapy? And since this is an important translational question, we thought we needed to figure this one out.
Live longer.
Yeah, of course they also die, but they, instead of dying in 4.5 months, they die 2 years later, for instance.
I think our bias reflects our background and training in molecular biology of oncogenes, so we believe that it's important to understand the genetic makeup of all these cells. I think Ron initiated that question. It's clear, at least as a neophyte in the field, I am quite impressed by the fact there are a bunch of genes which keep coming up in all pancreatic cancers. At least those could be detected in various different type of cell types that we heard this morning. And they can be also detected during the dynamic stage as the cancer cells progress. And that's a relatively easy technology to do that. Rather than be confused with cancer stem cell, initiating cell, survival cell, you'll be much better off to have a real marker available on the genetic lineages, that will give us a much better handle on them, because we also know a little bit about therapeutics of those genes.
Thank you. Other major questions here we've not gotten from the tables?
Max Schmidt, Indiana University. We came up with a lot of the same questions that everybody else did based upon the stimulating discussion, but one of the things that I think Diane had mentioned that was particularly disturbing to me is we can't get these tissue specimens from patients who have metastatic pancreas cancer from the primary and the metastatic site. And I think that our question really is, how can we shift that paradigm? Because that just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, we're all sitting around here saying that the profile of the tumor before we treat matters and the profile of the tumor after we treat matters. Why can't we convince physicians, oncologists, to stop spending billions of dollars on stuff that's not working, and for patients, practitioners to invest in an operation, whether it be laparoscopically or open, which most of these patients tolerate very well, to use a xenograft program to try to type these tumors, discover whether the stem cells are in the primary, in the metastatic site, use some targeted therapies to the metastatic or to the primary tumor. I mean, how can we get to where we can shift this paradigm? So that's our question.
We had similar questions that I think that each of the table mentioned, but we thought that Diane presented two things that were clear. One is that this is a distinct population that certainly has a tumorigenic capacity and is more resistant than the other cells associated with it. One of the practical questions then is this a means by which we test new therapies or new translational compounds? Actually, they ask their sensitivity to triple mark, or at least their benefit against triple markle cells. She demonstrated in a number of the normal cell lines we use, or at least a number of the traditional cancer cell lines we use, a small but significant percentage of those cell lines actually have triple marker cells. And obviously there's a big disconnect between the number of papers we see with new potential therapies that have no effect when they're translated. So should we now, as a measure of actually new therapies going forward, ask the question about their actually effectiveness against this set of cells? Now, we certainly can debate their origin and their plasticity, but they are identified to be very resistant and they tend to grow and repopulate. And so should be one of the measures now of new therapies, ask the question, how strongly and effective are they against this cell, this group of cells, in their cell lines or in the human tumor xenografts?
So in addition to affirming a lot of the other great ideas that have already been presented, the one question that we had that we hope to try to clarify, and it would be great if we could come up with some criteria before we leave here actually, is to try to identify either the single best assay or the most concrete definition, functional definition, of what we mean by the cancer stem cell. Certainly would personally help me a great deal if I could walk away with that understanding and that knowledge.
Just time for a couple.
Yeah, we've got two more questions, one Ralph wanted to ask and one Daphna wanted to ask, but she's too embarrassed. The other two were distinguishing between proliferative capacity and viability. That is, operationally, does the assay kill cells? And in the tumor, are the stem cells the cells that haven't undergone genetic change that prevents them from ever proliferating again versus them being real stem cells, quote unquote? The second point, which is Daphne's, it's actually mine, but I would take issue with table number 17. I would say that until we answer these questions, we do not aim therapeutic, we do not concentrate therapeutic testing on the so-called stem cell population. And I would go back to you and say, one of the problems with, there's a selection issue with cell lines. It's not tissue culture selection, it's investigator selection. The cell lines that grow in mice and that respond to therapies are the ones that are used. Any clinician can tell you for a long time that the pancreas cell lines respond to anything better than any patient does. That's not true in other diseases, and it's not true if you look at multiple lines. Okay, people like to get grants. Okay, and that's the basis for the selection in the cell lines. But I think this is a, you know, we could talk about it at length. You want to talk about tumor dormancy? Take a breast cancer patient that has a CR for 5 years on chemo with or tamoxifen, and then the tumor comes back. Then you can talk about stem cells, and you can talk about dormancy. I really think that this is the disease where it is least obvious that that has a role. That's supposed to be a provocative point.
Last question.
We were talking about abilities to ask and answer these questions, and one of the things that I heard Diane mention, just one word, relates to tools that are really important. We heard about the plasticity of tumor cells. We heard how the surrounding area, or the niche, if you want to call it, is very important in terms of programming it, but yet most people study one or the other, or not both, and so there's no ability right now to multiplex the signals that are going back and forth, and it's not a manner of simply pathways. These are networks. It's conglomerates of pathways that form networks. So one of the things that we need is the ability for multiplex analysis of both the tumor cells in context as well as their environment and what's happening.
Okay, it's time to break. We'll see you back in 15 minutes at 12:45.